Black Boy, Disc 12.
Chapter 16. In the spring, I took the postal examination again. Time had somewhat repaired the ravages of hunger, and I was able to meet the required physical weight. We moved to a larger apartment. My increased pay made better food possible. I was happy, in my own way. Working nights, I spent my days in experimental writing, filling endless pages with stream-of-consciousness Negro dialect, trying to depict the dwellers of the Black Belt as I felt and saw them. My reading in sociology had enabled me to discern many strange types of Negro characters, to identify many modes of Negro behavior. And what moved me above all was the frequency of mental illness, that tragic toll that the urban environment exacted of the Black peasant. Perhaps my writing was more an attempt at understanding than self-expression. A need that I didn't comprehend made me use words to create religious types, criminal types, the warped, the lost, the baffled. My pages were full of tension, frantic poverty, and death. But something was missing in my imaginative efforts. My flights of imagination were too subjective, too lacking in reference to social action. I hungered for a grasp of the framework of contemporary living, for a knowledge of the forms of life about me, for eyes to see the bony structures of personality, for theories to light up the shadows of conduct. While sorting mail in the post office, I met a young Irish chap whose sensibilities amazed me. We would take a batch of mail in our fingers, and while talking in low monotones out of the sides of our mouths, toss them correctly into their designated holes, and suddenly our hands would be empty, and we would have no memory of having worked. Most of the clerks could work in this automatic manner. The Irish chap and I had read a lot in common, and we laughed at the same sacred things. He was as cynical as I was regarding uplift and hope, and we were proud of having escaped what we called the childhood disease of metaphysical fear. I was introduced to the Irish chap's friends, and we formed a gang of Irish, Jewish, and Negro wits who poked fun at government, the masses, statesmen, and political parties. We assumed that all people were good to the degree to which they amused us, or to the extent to which we could make them objects of laughter. We ridiculed all ideas of protest, of organized rebellion, or revolution. We felt that all businessmen were thoroughly stupid, and that no other group was capable of rising to challenge them. We sneered at voting, for we felt that the choice between one political crook and another was too small for serious thought. We believed that man should live by hard facts alone, and we had so long ago put God out of our minds that we didn't even discuss him. During this cynical period, I met a Negro literary group on Chicago's South Side. It was composed of a dozen or more boys and girls, all of whom possessed academic learning, economic freedom, and vague ambitions to write. I found them more formal in manner than their white counterparts. They wore stylish clothes and were finicky about their personal appearance. I'd naively supposed that I would have much in common with them, but I found them preoccupied with twisted sex problems. Coming from a station in life which they, no doubt, would have branded lower class, I couldn't understand why they were so all-absorbed with sexual passion. I was encountering, for the first time, the full-fledged Negro Puritan invert, the emotionally sick. And I discovered that their ideas were but excuses for sex, leads to sex, hints at sex, substitutes for sex. In speech and action, they strove to act as un-Negro as possible, denying the racial and material foundations of their lives, accepting their class and racial status in ways so oblique that one had the impression that no difficulties existed for them. Though I had never had any assignments from a college professor, I had made much harder and more prolonged attempts at self-expression than any of them. Swearing love for art, they hovered on the edge of bohemian life. Always friendly, They could never be anybody's friend. Always reading. They could really never learn. Always boasting of their passions. They could never really feel and were afraid to live. The one group I met during those exploring days whose lives enthralled me was the Garveyites, an organization of black men and women who were forlornly seeking to return to Africa. Theirs was a passionate rejection of America, for they sensed, with that directness of which only the simple are capable, that they had no chance to live a full human life in America. Their lives were not cluttered with ideas in which they could only half believe. They could not create illusions which made them think they were living when they were not. Their daily lives were too nakedly harsh to permit of camouflage. I understood their emotions, for I partly shared them. The Garveyites had embraced a totally racialistic outlook, which endowed them with a dignity that I had never seen before in Negroes. On the walls of their dingy flats were maps of Africa and India and Japan, pictures of Japanese generals and admirals, portraits of Marcus Garvey in gaudy regalia, the faces of colored men and women from all parts of the world. I gave no credence to their ideology of Garveyism. It was, rather, the emotional dynamics of its adherents that evoked my admiration. Those Garveyites I knew could never understand why I liked them, but would never follow them, and I pitied them too much to tell them that they could never achieve their goal, that Africa was owned by the imperial powers of Europe, that their lives were alien to the mores of the natives of Africa, that they were people of the West, and would forever be so until they either merged with the West or perished. It was when the Garveyites spoke fervently of building their own country, of someday living within the boundaries of a culture of their own making, that I sensed the passionate hunger of their lives, that I caught a glimpse of the potential strength of the American Negro. Rumors of unemployment came, but I didn't listen to them. I heard of the organizational efforts of the Communist Party among the Negroes of the South Side, but communist activities were too remote to strike my mind with any degree of vividness. Whenever I met a person whom I suspected of being a communist, I talked to him affably, but from an emotional distance. I sensed that something terrible was beginning to happen in the world, but I tried to shut it out of my mind by reading and writing. When the time came for my appointment as a regular clerk, I was told that no appointments would be made for the time being. The volume of mail dropped. My hours of work dwindled. My paychecks grew small. Food became scarce at home. The hunger I thought I had left behind returned. One winter afternoon in 1929, en route to work from the library, I passed a newsstand on which the papers blazed, "Stocks crash. Billions fade." Most of what I had seen in the newspapers had never concerned me, so why should this? Newspapers reported the doings in a life I did not share. But the volume of mail fell so low that I worked but one or two nights a week. In the post office canteen, the boys stood about and talked. "The cops beat up some demonstrators today. The Reds had a picket line around the city hall. Wall Street's cracking down on the country. Surplus production's throwing millions out of work. There are more than 2 million unemployed. They don't count. They're always out of work. Read Karl Marx and get the answer, boys. There'll be a revolution if this keeps up." "Hell no. Americans are too dumb to make a revolution." The post office job ended, and again, I was out of work. I could no longer think that the tides of economics were not my concern. But how could I have had any possible say in how the world had been run? I had grown up in complete ignorance of what created jobs. Having been thrust out of the world because of my race, I had accepted my destiny by not being curious about what shaped it. The following summer, I was again called for temporary duty in the post office, and the work lasted into the winter. Aunt Cleo succumbed to a severe cardiac condition, and, hard on the heels of her illness, my brother developed stomach ulcers. To rush my worries to a climax, my mother also became ill. I felt that I was maintaining a private hospital. Finally, the post office work ceased altogether, and I haunted the city for jobs. But when I went into the streets in the morning, I saw sights that killed my hope for the rest of the day. Unemployed men loitered in doorways with blank looks in their eyes, sat dejectedly on front steps in shabby clothing, congregated in sullen groups on street corners, and filled all the empty benches in the parks of Chicago's South Side. Luck of a sort came when a distant cousin of mine, who was a superintendent at a Negro burial society, offered me a position on his staff as an agent. The thought of selling insurance policies to ignorant Negroes disgusted me.
"Well, if you don't sell them, somebody else will," my cousin told me. "You've got to eat, haven't you?"
During that year, I worked for several burial and insurance societies that operated among Negroes, and I received a new kind of education. I found that the burial societies, with some exceptions, were mostly rackets. Some of them conducted their business legitimately, but there were many that exploited the ignorance of their black customers. I was paid under a system that netted me $15 for every dollar's worth of new premiums that I placed upon the company's books, and for every dollar's worth of old premiums that lapsed, I was penalized $15. In addition, I was paid a commission of 10% on total premiums collected. But during the Depression, it was extremely difficult to persuade a black family to buy a policy carrying even a dime premium. I considered myself lucky if, after subtracting lapses from new business, there remained $15 that I could call my own. This gambling method of remuneration was practiced by some of the burial companies because of the tremendous turnover in policyholders, and the companies had to have a constant stream of new business to keep afloat. Whenever a black family moved or suffered a slight reverse in fortune, it usually let its policy lapse and later bought another policy from some other company. Each day now, I saw how the Negro in Chicago lived, for I visited hundreds of dingy flats filled with rickety furniture and ill-clad children. Most of the policyholders were illiterate and didn't know that their policies carried clauses severely restricting their benefit payments. And, as an insurance agent, it wasn't my duty to tell them. After tramping the streets and pounding on doors to collect premiums, I was dry, strained, too tired to read or write. I hungered for relief, and as a salesman of insurance to many young black girls, I found it. There were many comely black housewives who, trying desperately to keep up their insurance payments, were willing to make bargains to escape paying a 10-cent premium. I had a long, tortured affair with one girl by paying her 10-cent premium each week. She was an illiterate black child with a baby, whose father she didn't know. During the entire period of my relationship with her, she had but one demand to make of me. She wanted me to take her to a circus. Just what significance circuses had for her, I was never able to learn. After I had been with her one morning, in exchange for the dime premium, I sat on the sofa in the front room and began to read a book I had with me. She came over shyly.
"Let me see that," she said.
"What?" I asked.
"That book," she said.
I gave her the book. She looked at it intently. I saw that she was holding it upside down.
"What's in here you keep reading?" she asked.
"Can't you really read?" I asked.
"No," she giggled. "You know I can't read."
You can read some, I said.
No, she said.
I stared at her and wondered just what a life like hers meant in the scheme of things. And I came to the conclusion that it meant absolutely nothing. And neither did my life mean anything.
How come you looking at me that way for? She asked.
Nothing.
You don't talk much.
There isn't much to say.
I wished Jim was here, she sighed.
Who's Jim? I asked, jealous. I knew that she had other men, but I resented her mentioning them in my presence.
Just a friend, she said.
I hated her then hated myself for coming to her. Do you like Jim better than you like me? I asked.
No. Jim just likes to talk.
Then why do you be with me if you like Jim better? I asked, trying to make an issue and feeling a wave of disgust because I wanted to.
You all right, she said, giggling. I like you.
I could kill you, I said.
What?
She exclaimed. Nothing, I said, ashamed.
Kill me, you said. You crazy, man, she said.
Maybe I am, I muttered, angry that I was sitting beside a human being to whom I could not talk, angry with myself for coming to her, hating my wild and restless loneliness.
You ought to go home and sleep, she said. You're tired.
What do you ever think about? I demanded harshly.
Lot of things.
What, for example?
You,
she said, smiling. You know I mean just one dime to you each week, I said.
No, I think a lot of you.
Then what do you think?
About how you talk when you talk? I wished I could talk like you,
she said seriously.
Why?
I taunted her.
When you gonna take me to a circus? She demanded suddenly.
You ought to be in a circus, I said.
I'd like it, she said, her eyes shining.
I wanted to laugh, but her words sounded so sincere that I couldn't laugh. There's no circus in town, I said.
I bet there is, and you won't tell me, 'cause you don't want to take me, she said, pouting.
But there's no circus in town, I tell you.
When will one come?
I don't know.
Can't you read it in the papers? She asked.
There's nothing in the papers about a circus.
There is, she said. If I could read, I'd find it.
I laughed, and she was hurt.
There is a circus in town, she said stoutly.
There's no circus in town, I said. But if you want to learn to read, then I'll teach you. She nestled at my side, giggling. See that word? I said, pointing.
Yeah.
That's an and, I said. She doubled, giggling. What's the matter? I asked. She rolled on the floor, giggling.
What's so funny? I demanded. You, she giggled. You so funny.
I rose. The hell with you, I said.
Don't you go and cuss me now, she said. I don't cuss you.
I'm sorry, I said. I got my hat and went to the door.
I'll see you next week, she asked.
Maybe, I said. When I was on the sidewalk, she called to me from a window.
You promised to take me to a circus, remember?
Yes. I walked close to the window. What is it you like about a circus?
The animals, she said simply.
I felt that there was a hidden meaning, perhaps, in what she had said, but I couldn't find it. She laughed and slammed the window shut. Each time I left her, I resolved not to visit her again. I couldn't talk to her. I merely listened to her passionate desire to see a circus. She wasn't calculating. If she liked a man, she just liked him. Sex relations were the only relations she had ever had. No others were possible with her, so limited was her intelligence. Most of the other agents also had their bought girls, and they were extremely anxious to keep other agents from tampering with them. One day, a new section of the South Side was given to me as a part of my collection area, and the agent from whom the territory had been taken suddenly became very friendly with me.
"Say, right," he asked. "Did you collect from Ewing at Champlain Avenue yet?"
"Yes," I answered after consulting my book.
"How did you like her?"
he asked, staring at me.
"She's a good-looking number," I said. "You had anything to do with her yet?"
he asked.
"No, but I'd like to," I said, laughing.
"Look," he said, "I'm a friend of yours."
"Since when?" I countered.
"No, I'm really a friend," he said.
"What's on your mind?"
"Listen, that gal's sick," he said seriously.
"What do you mean?"
"She's got the clap," he said. "Keep away from her. She'll lay with anybody."
"Gee, I'm glad you told me," I said.
"You had your eye on her, didn't you?" he asked.
"Yes, I did," I said.
"Leave her alone," he said. "She'll get you down."
That night I told my cousin what the agent had said about Miss Ewing. My cousin laughed.
"That gal's all right," he said. "That agent's been fooling around with her. He told you she had a disease so that you'd be scared to bother her. He was protecting her from you."
That was the way black women were regarded by the black agents. Some of the agents were vicious. If they had claims to pay to a sick black woman, and if the woman was able to have sex relations with them, they would insist upon it, using the claim money as a bribe. If the woman refused, they would report to the office that the woman was a malingerer. The average black woman would submit because she needed the money badly. As an insurance agent, it was necessary for me to take part in one swindle. It appears that the Burial Society had originally issued a policy that was, from their point of view, too liberal in its provisions. And the officials decided to exchange the policies then in the hands of their clients for other policies carrying stricter clauses. Of course, this had to be done in a manner that would not allow the policyholder to know that his policy was being switched, that he was being swindled. I didn't like it, but there was only one thing I could do to keep from being a party to it. I could quit and starve. But I didn't feel that being honest was worth the price of starvation. The swindle worked in this way. In my visits to the homes of policyholders to collect premiums, I was accompanied by the superintendent, who claimed to the policyholder that he was making a routine inspection. The policyholder, usually an illiterate black woman, would dig up her policy from the bottom of a trunk or a chest and hand it to the superintendent. Meanwhile, I would be marking the woman's premium book, an act which would distract her from what the superintendent was doing. The superintendent would exchange the old policy for a new one, which was identical in color, serial number, and beneficiary, but which carried much smaller payments. It was dirty work, and I wondered how I could stop it. And when I could think of no safe way, I would curse myself and the victims and forget about it. The black owners of the burial societies were leaders in the Negro communities and were respected by whites. As I went from house to house collecting money, I saw black men mounted upon soap boxes at street corners, bellowing about bread, rights, and revolution. I liked their courage, but I doubted their wisdom. The speakers claimed that Negroes were angry, that they were about to rise and join their white fellow workers to make a revolution. I was in and out of many Negro homes each day, and I knew that the Negroes were lost, ignorant,
sick in mind and body. I saw that a vast distance separated the agitators from the masses, a distance so vast that the agitators didn't know how to appeal to the people they sought to lead. Some mornings I found leaflets on my steps telling of China, Russia, and Germany. On some days I witnessed as many as 5,000 jobless Negroes, led by communists, surging through the streets. I would watch them with an aching heart, firmly convinced that they were being duped. But if I had been asked to give them another solution for their problems, I wouldn't have known how. It became a habit of mine to visit Washington Park of an afternoon, after collecting a part of my premiums, and I would wander through crowds of unemployed Negroes, pausing here and there to sample the dialect or indignation of communist speakers. What I heard and saw baffled and angered me. The Negro communists were deliberately careless in their personal appearance, wearing their shirt collars turned in to make V's at their throats, wearing their caps — they wore caps because Lenin had worn caps — with their visors turned backward, tilted upward at the nape of their necks. Many of their mannerisms, pronunciations, and turns of speech had been consciously copied from white communists whom they had recently met. While engaged in conversation, they stuck their thumbs in their suspenders, or put their left hands into their shirt bosoms, or hooked their thumbs into their back pockets, as they had seen Lenin or Stalin do in photographs. Though they didn't know it, they were naively practicing magic. They thought that if they acted like the men who had overthrown the Tsar, then surely they ought to be able to win their freedom in America. In speaking, they rolled their R's in continental style, pronouncing party as party, stressing the last syllable, having picked up the habit from white communists. Comrades became comrades, and distribute, which they had known how to pronounce all their lives, was twisted into distribute, with the accent on the last instead of the second syllable, a mannerism which they copied from Polish communist immigrants, who didn't know how to pronounce the word. Many sensitive Negroes agreed with the communist program, but refused to join their ranks because of the shabby quality of the Negroes whom the communists had already admitted to membership. When speaking from the platform, the Negro communists, eschewing the traditional gestures of the Negro preacher, as though they didn't possess the strength to develop their own style of communist preaching, stood straight, threw back their heads, brought the edge of the right palm down, hammer-like, into the outstretched left palm in a series of jerky motions to pound their points home, a mannerism that characterized Lenin's method of speaking. When they walked, their stride quickened. All the peasant hesitancy of their speech vanished as their voices became clipped, terse. In debate, they interrupted their opponents in a tone of voice that was an octave higher, and if their opponents raised their voices to be heard, the communists raised theirs still higher, until shouts rang out over the park. Hence, the only truth that prevailed was that which could be shouted and quickly understood. Their emotional certainty seemed buttressed by access to a fund of knowledge denied to ordinary men, but a day's observation of their activities was sufficient to reveal all their thought processes. An hour's listening disclosed the fanatical intolerance of minds sealed against new ideas, new facts, new feelings, new attitudes, new hints at ways to live. They denounced books they had never read, people they had never known, ideas they could never understand, and doctrines whose names they could not pronounce. Communism, instead of making them leap forward with fire in their hearts to become masters of ideas and life, had frozen them at an even lower level of ignorance than had been theirs before they met communism. When Hoover threatened to drive the bonus marchers from Washington, one Negro communist speaker said, "If he drives the bonus marchers out of Washington, the people will rise up and make a revolution." I went to him, determined to get at what he really meant. "You know that even if the United States Army actually kills the bonus marchers, there'll be no revolution," I said. "You don't know the indignation of the masses," he exploded. "But you don't seem to know what it takes to make a revolution," I explained. "Revolutions are rare occurrences." "You underestimate the masses," he told me. "No, I know the masses of Negroes very well," I said. "But I don't believe that a revolution is pending. Revolutions come through concrete historical processes."
"You're an intellectual," he said, smiling disdainfully.
A few days later, after Hoover had had the bonus marchers driven from Washington at the point of bayonets, I accosted him. "What about that revolution you predicted, if the bonus marchers were driven out?" I asked.
"The prerequisite conditions did not exist," he shrugged and muttered.
I left him, wondering why he felt it necessary to make so many ridiculous overstatements. I couldn't refute the general communist analysis of the world. The only drawback was that their world was just too simple for belief. I liked their readiness to act, but they seemed lost in folly, wandering in fantasy. For them, there was no yesterday or tomorrow, only the living moment of today. Their only task was to annihilate the enemy that confronted them in any manner possible. At times, their speeches, glowing with rebellion, were downright offensive to lowly, hungry Negroes. Once, a Negro communist speaker inveighing against religion said,
"There ain't no goddamn God. If there is, I hereby challenge him to strike me dead."
He paused dramatically before his vast black audience for God to act, but God declined. He then pulled out his watch.
"Maybe God didn't hear me," he yelled. "I'll give him 2 more minutes."
Then, with sarcasm,
"Mr. God, kill me."
He waited, looking mockingly at his watch. The audience laughed uneasily.
"I'll tell you where to find God," the speaker went on in a hard, ranting voice. "When it rains at midnight, take your hat, turn it upside down on a floor in a dark room, and you'll have God."
I had to admit that I had never heard atheism of so militant a nature, but the communist speaker seemed to be amusing and frightening the people more than he was convincing them.
"If there is a God up there in that empty sky," the speaker roared on, "I'll reach up there and grab him by his beard and jerk him down here on this hungry earth and cut his throat."
He wagged his head.
"Now, let God dare me."
The audience was shocked into silence for a moment. Then it yelled with delight. I shook my head and walked away. That was not the way to destroy people's outworn beliefs. They were acting like irresponsible children. I was now convinced that they didn't know the complex nature of Negro life, didn't know how great was the task to which they had set themselves. They had rejected the state of things as they were, and that seemed to me to be the first step toward embracing a creative attitude toward life. I felt that it wasn't until one wanted the world to be different that one could look at the world with will and emotion. But these men had rejected what was before their eyes, without quite knowing what they had rejected and why. I felt that the Negro couldn't live a full human life under the conditions imposed upon him by America. And I felt, too, that America, for different reasons, couldn't live a full human life. It seemed to me, then, that if the Negro solved his problem, he would be solving infinitely more than his problem alone.
I felt certain that the Negro could never solve his problem until the deeper problem of American civilization had been faced and solved. And because the Negro was the most cast out of all the outcast people in America, I felt that no other group in America could tackle this problem of what our American lives meant so well as the Negro could. But, as I listened to the communist Negro speakers, I wondered if the Negro, blasted by 300 years of oppression, could possibly cast off his fear and corruption and rise to the task. Could the Negro ever possess himself, learn to know what had happened to him in relation to the aspirations of Western society? It seemed to me that for the Negro to try to save himself, he would have to forget himself and try to save a confused materialistic nation from its own drift toward self-destruction. Could the Negro accomplish this miracle? Could he take up his bed and walk? Election time was nearing, and a Negro Republican precinct captain asked me to help him round up votes. I had no interest in the candidates, but I needed the money. I went from door to door with the precinct captain and discovered that the whole business was one long process of bribery, that people voted for $3 for the right to continue their illicit trade in sex or alcohol. On election day, I went into the polling booth and drew the curtain behind me and unfolded my ballots. I stood there. The sordid implications of politics flashed through my mind. Big Bill Thompson headed the local Republican machine, and I knew that he was using the Negro vote to control the city hall. In turn, he was engaged in vast political deals of which the Negro voters' political innocence had no notion. With my pencil, I wrote in a determined scrawl across the face of the ballots, "I protest this fraud." I knew that my gesture was futile, but I wanted somebody to know that out of that vast sea of ignorance in the Black Belt, there was at least one person who knew the game for what it was. I collected my $10 and went home. The depression deepened, and I couldn't sell insurance to hungry Negroes. I sold my watch and scouted for cheaper rooms. I found a rotting building and rented an apartment in it. The place was dismal. Plaster was falling from the walls. The wooden stairs sagged. When my mother saw it, she wept. I felt bleak. I hadn't done what I had come to the city to do. One morning I rose, and my mother told me that there was no food for breakfast. I knew that the city had opened relief stations, but each time I thought of going into one of them, I burned with shame. I sat for hours, fighting hunger, avoiding my mother's eyes. Then I rose, put on my hat and coat, and went out. As I walked toward the Cook County Bureau of Public Welfare to plead for bread, I knew that I had come to the end of something. Chapter 17. When I reached the relief station, I felt that I was making a public confession of my hunger. I sat waiting for hours, resentful of the mass of hungry people about me. My turn finally came, and I was questioned by a middle-class Negro woman who asked me for a short history of my life. As I waited again, I became aware of something happening in the room. The black men and women were mumbling quietly among themselves. They hadn't known one another before they had come here. But now, their timidity and shame were wearing off, and they were exchanging experiences. Before this, they had lived as individuals, each somewhat afraid of the other, each seeking his own pleasure, each stanch in that degree of Americanism that had been allowed him. But now, life had tossed them together, and they were learning to know the sentiments of their neighbors for the first time. Their talking was enabling them
to sense the collectivity of their lives, and some of their fear was passing. Did the relief officials realize what was happening? No. If they had, they would have stopped it. But they saw their clients through the eyes of their profession, saw only what their science allowed them to see. As I listened to the talk, I could see black minds shedding many illusions. These people now knew that the past had betrayed them, had cast them out. But they didn't know what the future would be like, didn't know what they wanted. Yes, some of the things that the communists said were true. They maintained that there came times in history when a ruling class could no longer rule, and I sat looking at the beginnings of anarchy. To permit the birth of this new consciousness in these people was proof that those who ruled didn't quite know what they were doing, assuming that they were trying to save themselves and their class. Had they understood what was happening, they would never have allowed millions of perplexed and defeated people to sit together for long hours and talk, for out of their talk was rising a new realization of life. And once this new conception of themselves had formed, no power on earth could alter it. I left the relief station with the promise that food would be sent to me, but I also left with the knowledge that the relief officials hadn't wanted to give me. I had felt the possibility of creating a new understanding of life in the minds of people rejected by the society in which they lived. People to whom the Chicago Daily Tribune referred contemptuously as the idle ones, as though these people had deliberately sought their present state of helplessness. Who would give these people a meaningful way of life? Communist theory defined these people as the molders of the future of mankind. But the communist speeches I had heard in the park had mocked that definition. These people, of course, weren't ready for a revolution. They hadn't abandoned their past lives by choice, but because they simply couldn't live the old way any longer. Now, what new faith would they embrace? The day I begged bread from the city officials was the day that showed me I was not alone in my loneliness. Society had cast millions of others with me, but how could I be with them? How many understood what was happening? My mind swam with questions that I couldn't answer. I was slowly beginning to comprehend the meaning of my environment. A sense of direction was beginning to emerge from the conditions of my life. I began to feel something more powerful than I could express. My speech and manner changed. My cynicism slid from me. I grew open and questioning. I wanted to know. If I were a member of the class that rules, I would post men in all the neighborhoods of the nation, not to spy upon or club rebellious workers, not to break strikes or disrupt unions, but to ferret out those who no longer respond to the system in which they live. I would make it known that the real danger doesn't stem from those who seek to grab their share of the wealth through force, or from those who try to defend their property through violence. For both of these groups, by their affirmative acts, support the values of the system in which they live. The millions that I would fear are those who don't dream of the prizes that the nation holds forth. For it is in them, though they may not know it, that a revolution has taken place and is biding its time to translate itself into a new and strange way of life. I feel that the Negro's relation to America is symbolically peculiar, and from the Negro's ultimate reactions to their trapped state, a lesson can be learned about America's future. Negroes are told in a language they cannot possibly misunderstand that their native land is not their own. And when they, acting upon impulses which they share with whites, try to assert a claim to their birthright, whites retaliate with terror, never pausing to consider the consequences should the Negroes give up completely. They never dream that they would face a situation far more terrifying if they were confronted by Negroes who made no claims at all than by those who are buoyed by social aggressiveness. My knowledge of how Negroes react to their plight makes me declare that no man can possibly be individually guilty of treason, that an insurgent act is but a man's desperate answer to those who twist his environment, so that he cannot fully share the spirit of his native land. Treason is a crime of the state. Christmas came, and I was once more called to the post office for temporary work. Again, I met the Irish chap, and we discussed world happenings, the vast armies of unemployed, the rising tide of radical action. I now detected a change in the attitudes of the whites I met. Their privations were making them regard Negroes with new eyes, and for the first time, I was invited to their homes. When the work in the post office ended, I was assigned by the relief system as an orderly to a medical research institute and one of the largest and wealthiest hospitals in Chicago. I cleaned operating rooms, dog, rat, mice, cat, and rabbit pens, and fed guinea pigs. Four of us Negroes worked there, and we occupied an underworld position, remembering that we must restrict ourselves, when not engaged upon some task, to the basement corridors, so that we would not mingle with white nurses, doctors, or visitors. The sharp line of racial division drawn by the hospital authorities came to me the first morning when I walked along an underground corridor and saw two long lines of women coming toward me. A line of white girls marched past, clad in starched uniforms that gleamed white. Their faces were alert, their steps quick, their bodies lean and shapely, their shoulders erect, their faces lit with the light of purpose. And after them came a line of black girls, old, fat, dressed in ragged gingham, walking loosely, carrying tin cans of soap powder, rags, mops, brooms. I wondered what law of the universe kept them from being mixed. The sun would not have stopped shining had there been a few black girls in the first line, and the earth would not have stopped whirling on its axis had there been a few white girls in the second line. But the two lines I saw graded status in purely racial terms. Of the three Negroes who worked with me, one was a boy about my own age, Bill, who was either sleepy or drunk most of the time. Bill straightened his hair, and I suspected that he kept a bottle hidden somewhere in the piles of hay which we fed to the guinea pigs. He didn't like me, and I didn't like him, though I tried harder than he to conceal my dislike. We had nothing in common, except that we were both black and lost. While I contained my frustration, he drank to drown his. Often I tried to talk to him, tried in simple words to convey to him some of my ideas, and he would listen in sullen silence. Then one day he came to me with an angry look on his face. "I got it," he said. "What have you got?" I asked. "This old race problem you keep talking about," he said. "What about it?" "Well, it's this way," he explained seriously. "Let the government give every man a gun and 5 bullets. Then let us all start over again. Make it just like it was in the beginning. The ones who come out on top, white or black, let them rule." His simplicity terrified me. I had never met a Negro who was so irredeemably brutalized. I stopped pumping my ideas into Bill's brain for fear that the fumes of alcohol might send him reeling toward some fantastic fate. The other two Negroes were elderly and had been employed in the Institute for 15 years or more. One was Brand, a short, black, morose bachelor. The other was Cook, a tall, yellow, spectacled fellow, who spent his spare time keeping track of world events through the Chicago Daily Tribune. Brand and Cook hated each other for a reason that I was never able to determine, and they spent a good part of each day quarreling.
When I began working at the Institute, I recalled my adolescent dream of wanting to be a medical research worker. Daily I saw young Jewish boys and girls receiving instruction in chemistry and medicine that the average black boy or girl could never receive. When I was alone, I wandered and poked my fingers into strange chemicals, watched intricate machines trace red and black lines upon ruled paper. At times, I paused and stared at the walls of the rooms, at the floors, at the wide desks at which the white doctors sat, and I realized, with a feeling that I could never quite get used to, that I was looking at the world of another race. My interest in what was happening in the Institute amused the three other Negroes with whom I worked. They had no curiosity about white folks' things, while I wanted to know if the dogs being treated for diabetes were getting well, if the rats and mice in whom cancer had been induced showed any signs of responding to treatment. I wanted to know the principle that lay behind the Asheim-Zondik tests that were made with rabbits, the Wasserman tests that were made with guinea pigs. But when I asked a timid question, I found that even Jewish doctors had learned to imitate the sadistic method of humbling a Negro that the native-born whites had cultivated. "If you know too much, boy, your brains might explode," a doctor said one day. Each Saturday morning, I assisted a young Jewish doctor in slitting the vocal cords of a fresh batch of dogs from the city pound. The object was to devocalize the dogs so that their howls wouldn't disturb the patients in the other parts of the hospital. I held each dog as the doctor injected Nembutal into its veins to make it unconscious. Then I held the dog's jaws open as the doctor inserted the scalpel and severed the vocal cords. Later, when the dogs came to, they would lift their heads to the ceiling and gape in a soundless wail. The sight became lodged in my imagination as a symbol of silent suffering. To me, Nembutal was a powerful and mysterious liquid, but when I asked questions about its properties, I could not obtain a single intelligent answer. The young Jewish doctor simply ignored me with, "Come on, bring the next dog. I haven't got all day." One Saturday morning, after I had held the dogs for their vocal cords to be slit, the doctor left the Nembutal on a bench. I picked it up, uncorked it, and smelt it. It was odorless. Suddenly, Brand ran to me with a stricken face. "What are you doing?" he asked. "I was smelling this stuff to see if it had any odor," I said.
"Did you really smell it?"
he asked me. "Yes."
"Oh, God!" he exclaimed.
"What's the matter?" I asked.
"You shouldn't have done that,"
he shouted.
"Why?"
He grabbed my arm and jerked me across the room.
"Come on!"
he yelled, snatching open the door. "What's the matter?" I asked.
"I gotta get you to a doctor before it's too late,"
he gasped. Had my foolish curiosity made me inhale something dangerous? "But is it poisonous?"
"Run, boy," he said, pulling me. "You'll fall dead."
Filled with fear, with Brand pulling my arm, I rushed out of the room, raced across a rear areaway, into another room, then down a long corridor. I wanted to ask Brand what symptoms I must expect, but we were running too fast. Brand finally stopped, gasping for breath. My heart beat wildly, and my blood pounded in my head. Brand then dropped to the concrete floor, stretched out on his back, and yelled with laughter, shaking all over. He beat his fists against the concrete. He moaned, giggled. I tried to master my outrage, wondering if some of the white doctors had told him to play the joke. He rose and wiped tears from his eyes, still laughing. I walked away from him. He knew that I was angry, and he followed me.
"Don't get mad,"
he gasped through his laughter. "Go to hell," I said.
"I couldn't help it,"
he giggled.
You looked at me like you'd believe anything I said. Man, you was scared.
He leaned against the wall, laughing again, stomping his feet. I was angry, for I felt that he would spread the story. I knew that Bill and Cook never ventured beyond the safe bounds of Negro living, and they would never blunder into anything like this. And if they heard about this, they would laugh for months.
Brand, if you mention this, I'll kill you, I swore. You ain't mad,
he asked, laughing, staring at me through tears. Sniffing, Brand walked ahead of me. I followed him back into the room that housed the dogs. All day, while at some task, he would pause and giggle, then smother it with his hand, looking at me out of the corner of his eyes, shaking his head. He laughed at me for a week. I kept my temper and let him amuse himself. I finally found out the properties of Nembutal by consulting medical books, but I never told Brand. One summer morning, just as I began work, a young Jewish boy came to me with a stopwatch in his hand.
Doctor wants me to time you when you clean a room, he said. We're trying to make the institute more efficient.
I'm doing my work and getting through on time, I said.
This is the boss's order, he said.
Why don't you work for a change? I blurted, angry.
Now look, he said, this is my work. Now you work.
I got mop and pail, sprayed a room with disinfectant, and scrubbed at coagulated blood and hardened dog, rat, and rabbit feces. The normal temperature of a room was 90, but as the sun beat down upon the skylights, the temperature rose above 100. Stripped to my waist, I slung the mop, moving steadily like a machine, hearing the Jewish boy press the button on the stopwatch as I finished cleaning a room. I worked from 7 in the morning until noon, and I was limp, washed out.
Well, how is it? I asked.
It took you 17 minutes to clean the last room, he said. That ought to be the time for each room.
But that room was not very dirty, I said.
You have 17 rooms to clean, he went on, as though I had not spoken. 17 times 17 makes 4 hours and 49 minutes. He wrote upon a little pad. After lunch, clean the 5 flights of stone stairs. I timed a boy who scrubbed 1 step and multiplied that time by the number of steps. You ought to be through at 6.
Suppose I want relief, I asked.
You'll manage, he said, and left.
Never had I felt so much the slave as when I scoured those stone steps each afternoon. Working against time, I would wet 5 steps, sprinkle soap powder. Then a white doctor or nurse would come, and instead of avoiding the soppy steps, walk on them and track the dirty water onto the steps that I had already cleaned. To obviate this, I cleaned but 2 steps at a time, a distance over which a 10-year-old child could step. But it did no good. The white people still plopped their feet down into the dirty water and muddied the other clean steps. If I ever really hotly hated unthinking whites, it was then. Not once during my entire stay at the Institute did a single white person show enough courtesy to avoid a wet step. I would be on my knees, scrubbing, sweating, pouring out what limited energy my body could wring from my meager diet, and I would hear feet approaching. I would pause and curse with tense lips. These sons of bitches are going to dirty these steps again. God damn their souls to hell. Sometimes, a sadistically observant white man would notice that he had tracked dirty water up the steps, and he would look back down at me and smile and say,
"Boy, we sure keep you busy, don't we?"
And I wouldn't be able to answer.
This ends Disc 12.